gather around people wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. Or the times, they are a-changing.
Second Sunday, 1968, year of revolution.
The mothers and fathers throughout the land, and don't criticize what you can't understand. Your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. Your old road is rapidly aging. Please get out of the new one if you can't lend your hand. For the times, they are a-changing.
I find it shocking that young people who are passing through the revolving door of a university, spending 4 years in a university, think that they have the right to dictate rather than to be there to learn. But these wise guys want to come in and tell the university what they want to accept out of it. I find it incredible.
And what you think then in the role of a university is that massive students pour in, are filled with facts, and then pour out and use these facts.
Think and use their brains and assimilate the knowledge that has been accumulated over the centuries of civilization.
If you go into a university, if you go anywhere and you do anything, you should have a right, to some sort of right, to have a say in that which affects you.
No, you can get up and leave.
Are you saying then if we don't like this country, we should leave?
Or to change it.
But you, precisely. But you don't. That's it.
But when I say
change it
in
through
the
a ballot,
the way agreed by the majority.
We are in the country, and I want to stay in this country, and I want to stay as an American. However, if there are certain things in America which I don't believe in, I have a certain right. I have a definite right to
you
make my voice known.
Responsibility, yes.
I have a responsibility to make my voice known.
Heard,
therefore,
yes.
If my voice, as a student, as a young person, is not heard, is not listened to, through peaceful demonstrations, petitions, marches, if it's not listened to then, what do you do then? Do you just give up and go back to studying and say, well, this is the situation, accept it?
You do not give up. You do not get sucked into rioting, looting, destroying. The answer is set down in our own democratic processes. It sounds...
But they don't work.
Oh, they do work.
It has to work.
We have constant change in our way of life. Our society has changed considerably. The university has changed considerably. But it has not changed by rioting or destroying.
Oh, that's not true whatsoever.
Now, it is true, a deplorable truth, that violence will always breed a reaction. And it is deplorable that we sometimes take no action until there is violence. However, I maintain that there was another way that this could be done.
Well, tell me. Tell us. If you can tell us.
If I say that democracy doesn't work...
It doesn't. It didn't work. It may work.
That the only solution is this dirty approach. You have achieved some results by violence, by military.
No.
You have achieved the results that you did not go to the university to achieve. You achieved results in stopping a playground,
completely.
But you did not go to the university to decide the whereabouts of a playground.
You say that the role of the university is purely to teach. But what happens if you build a multi-billion dollar institution in the middle of one of the world's biggest slums? Now, when you do that, the institution has some sort of responsibility to its environment, especially when it encroaches on that
Very
environment.
Very good, I agree.
And therefore,
if
an encroachment takes place, that community should have some sort of voice in what happens to their land, to their buildings, to their houses.
Yes.
Now, if they don't, there's something wrong. Now, should I just say, well, there's something wrong here, but I have no right to to have a say in it, therefore get out. I should remove myself. I do not feel that way. The students do not feel that way. But you seem to classify a student in a very small niche in society, whereas we feel that the university and our role in the university is just one aspect, it's just a continuation of the time when we were began to think for ourselves, some of us later than others, but some of us, say, at the age of 14 and 15.
No, it's a note of piety in all this that that appalls me, that you think because you are a member of the university that you have to settle the fate and all the wrongs all around you. I still insist that you're there as a member of the university to absorb a certain amount of knowledge.
Do you really feel...
And get out. And it's only that.
Get out and go where?
And then become a member of society.
Oh, you don't think that the student is a member of society, then?
Not quite. I don't think you're fully qualified yet.
Why not?
Oh, the times, they are a-changing.
Good evening. I'm Lou Wood, NBC News. And the times, indeed, are a-changing. The sort of angry perplexity of the father we just heard, played against his son's young sureness, are perhaps symbolic of much more than the campus revolution. Perhaps most of us who were born before World War II feel a kinship with that father, a sense of being a little out of focus, a sense of being caught in a whirlpool. In short, a feeling that the world is moving too fast and we want to tell it, slow down. We can tell it, but it won't. So therefore, we might as well at least try to understand it. We might as well at least examine it. And that has been the mission of the Second Sunday series during 1968, a year of revolution. We have examined that revolution, not only the one on campus, but the larger, though perhaps less spectacular one, going on all around us, in every field from religion to medicine, from police work to sex. Tonight, the last Second Sunday of the year, we'll try to sum up, try to find out just where we are, and perhaps, with luck, we'll also get some glimmer of where we're headed. For openers, though, we cannot, much as we might like to, disagree with Bob Dylan that...
The line it is drawn, the curse it is cast. The slow one now will later be fast, as the present now will later be past. The order is rapidly fading, and the first one now will later be last. For the times, they are a-changing.
The loudest, most spectacular, and in many ways the most shocking part of this year of revolution has emanated or blasted from the college campuses. Great and small universities together have felt the wrath of students. University presidents have been imprisoned in their offices. Administration buildings have been commandeered and occupied like enemy countries. Police have invaded the campus to keep order, thus shattering a tradition hundreds of years old that campuses police themselves. Who are these young revolutionaries? The easy thing to say is that they're a bunch of dirty Reds, or at the very least, dupes of communism. But that's too easy. It's true that there are communists among the leaders. One such is Bettina Aptecker, an admitted communist, whose father Herbert is considered the chief theologian of the Communist Party USA. Miss Aptecker was a leader when it all began at the University of California at Berkeley back in 1962. But another leader, Mario Savio, certainly was not a communist. So the easy way will not work. And the question remains, who are they? NBC News reporter Paul Friedman put that question to a distinguished professor and sociologist at the University of Wisconsin, Dr. Maurice Seidman. Here is his rather startling reply.
From what I can gather, from what I've been able to see, are the most thoughtful kids, the best students, the kids with the highest grade point averages, who are opting out. The ones who are most concerned about learning, most concerned about a university as a community of scholars rather than as a place to pursue a career and so forth. Those are the kids who get involved in it. The fact of the matter is that these are the sons and daughters of respectable, quote and unquote, people. These are the sons and daughters of doctors and lawyers and professionals and businessmen of all kinds. They think that the society must be a pretty ugly society that has huge slums and that makes black people live as they do. They think they get concerned and they show up at rallies for migrant workers because they can't understand how migrant workers should be forced to live like that. They're concerned also about simple things, about the middle class. Many of the most active kids are concerned about middle class oppression. What kind of a life is it for a guy to get up in the morning and go to work and sit at some desk and to do some work that's uninteresting for him? Or if he does work that's interesting to him, it's involved in selling goods to other people who don't need them in the first place. The need to stop the fighting and to get out of Vietnam is to them very clear, perfectly clear. And the one thing that is common to most of them, I would say almost to all of them who I've ever spoken to or who raise this issue, is that that's how they see it, that you can't be silent on this issue. These students, unlike students since the Great Depression, were coming of age at a time in which there was a major movement at home emerging, namely the civil rights movement. And it appealed to them at a time when they didn't have the hang-ups that their parents did about fear of McCarthyism and repression or of economic depression. The vast majority of students that I come into contact with now who aren't even activists don't have any confidence that the United States knows what it stands for any longer, that Americans know what they stand for. You know, those who go further and talk about getting rid of the military-industrial complex, again, doesn't necessarily mean that they're talking about a radical reconstruction of their society. So it's not necessarily a revolutionary alternative that they're holding out. The largest, most imperative thrust behind all of their activities, all their demands, is that they want to feel that they are part of a society which ordinary people control.
To sum up, they are for an end to the war in Vietnam. They are for civil rights. They are for more meaning in the lives of more people. They are for more teaching and less research from their professors. And they are for a society which ordinary people control. What are they against? We asked our Sergeant Shriver, who headed the Youth Corps for many years and got to know young people fairly well. Here is his summary of the targets of rebellion.
They're rebelling against big labor, which has become, in some cases, restrictive, which doesn't permit people to get into the labor movement the way it used to. It's busy protecting the gains which have been made. I'm not just critical of that. I'm just observing that that's one of the things I think they're rebelling against. I think they're rebelling against the churches. For example, I happen to be a Catholic, and I think it's interesting that many young people feel that the church shouldn't have as much tax-free property as it used to have. I think in the case of business, they're revolting against big business. They don't want to be the man in the gray flannel suit in some giant corporation where you're locked into a particular system where the corporation is the big thing in your existence. I think they resent it when they see their fathers having to just trim their sails, their father's sails, I mean, to fit into a structure which is not doing the maximum for that for their father as a human being. They don't want to be so constricted by a big business structure.
But have the students accomplished anything? Almost a year ago, we put that question to students in various parts of the country, concerned and active students. Their first target was the Vietnam War. Here, a boy and a girl from a Midwest university.
We haven't accomplished much with the more peaceful types of demonstrations. And we're really pretty frustrated, or at least I am, at not being able to really get the ear of the president and have him take anything we say seriously.
I think we all realize now that there are no leaders that are going to come out of the establishment to help us. If change is going to come in this country, it's going to come through through very small people like us, you know, just individual, personal people like us, you know, becoming very serious about the situation and, beginning to work to spread our numbers and, you know, work for the long, long range, maybe the seventh war from now.
But the establishment was listening. Senator Eugene McCarthy came forward to run for president on a peace ticket, and the young people flooded the country for him. Senator Robert Kennedy followed, and more students turned up. Suddenly, the nation realized that the war was unpopular. The president listened. Peace talks were initiated, no matter how little they seemed to have accomplished. The bombing was halted in the north, and, not incidentally, the president announced his retirement. It is much too oversimple to say that the beginnings of peace were directly caused by the campus revolution, but certainly there is some relationship. Apparently the president thinks so, too, and wonders, as do many of us, if things are going too fast, too far. Here is what he said last week.
Riots and violence torment our cities all over the globe. Schools and colleges are prevented from educating students. A report the other day I saw where universities in more than 25 of the leading nations had been taken over. Laws are flouted. Moral and political leaders are struck down by assassination. Every society today is emerging and discovering new divisions and new separations and new alienations. And we just cannot allow the centrifugal forces at work to break up the democratic societies which so many have labored so long to build and to perfect.
Vietnam was only one of the things the students rebelled against. Another was the slow pace of civil rights, and there has been more enforcement of laws in that area. A third thing was the university itself. One boy puts it this way.
The problem with today's university is probably basically its size. The student is really a number. Neither your professor nor any member of the administration knows who you are. They know your number, and they press a button, and an IBM machine brings out your record, and, oh, you're so-and-so. They just don't know you. There is very little communication today. Very few students in any of the colleges ever visit their professors' homes. You don't go out for coffee anymore. You don't go out for a beer. You don't go out on the town or a night just talking about religion or about any of these other problems that society is facing the new college student.
Certainly, research is still pursued and government projects still occupy many university hours. But administrations have been shaken up. Such world-famous men as Chancellor Clark Kerr of the University of California and President Grayson Kirk of Columbia have been forced out, along with countless other campus officials across the country. Only last week, San Francisco State College got its third president of the year, and the campus rebellion there is still going on. Here's a report from NBC News correspondent Robert Lazich.
This is the sound of dissent. Students on strike at San Francisco State College, demanding the campus be shut down. Turbulence is not new to this campus. It has had three presidents this year. Only one stayed in office long enough to go through ceremonial inauguration. San Francisco State was once a hotbed of dissent against the Vietnam War. Now the fight is for more educational opportunities for minorities. Race runs through this current strike, and black militants backed by Negro community leaders are involved. Last year, Black Panther George Murray led a band of Negroes who invaded the campus newspaper office and beat up the staffers. Murray was an English instructor on campus until his suspension 2 months ago, reportedly for urging blacks to carry guns on campus. The Black Students Union has a list of 10 demands they want met. Reinstatement of Murray is one of them. The others include creation of a black studies department leading to a degree and admission for any Negro who wants to go to college. The campus Third World group, representing other minorities, has 15 demands. Many of them overlap with the BSU's. Most of the demands have sympathy on campus. Officials generally agree most are justified. But San Francisco State College is one of 20 state colleges in California with 200,000 students under the umbrella of the college trustees. They write the rules. They dole out the money. When there wasn't enough money to satisfy the demands, a strike was called. It first led to closing of the campus, then reopening with police power. That's where it's been most of the week. The students and others complain that the trustees are too far from the problem to cope with it. They should let the campus run itself. As one girl put it in her court appearance, "It's our school. We know how to run it." Governor Reagan and others counter that the people who provide the money to run a college, the taxpayers, should have a say in how it's run. There's little doubt that San Francisco State will have an ethnic studies program, that more minority students will be admitted. But the old timetables don't work anymore. The minorities are rushing for identity. They're tired of waiting.
Perhaps the most touching and least understood reason behind the rebellion is a general dissatisfaction with life in the United States. Here is how some students see it.
For one thing, what bothers me is the middle class complacency. There's certainly, they're nice liberal people, but they don't want anybody to burst their little bubble. It's much more important that the lawn gets mowed on Saturday than what happens on Sunday in the slums. It would be nice to have open housing, but I don't want to sell my house to a Negro because that's going to start trouble in the neighborhood. And, you know, my child still has to go to school here, and I'm not a troublemaker. I just want to live my life. And there's too much of this. And I think this goes with the whole middle class perspective and the material goods. It's not materialism. It's not the objects. It's the attitude that goes with them.
Ours is not the revolution of the empty belly. And this is why our fight is not the same as the fight in Cuba or the fight in Vietnam. Ours is the fight of a full belly and an empty life. You know, and we've begun to get an opportunity to begin to examine, to look for something more than the full belly and try to fill out the other forms of life.
Thus, the campus rebellion. We may not like it or really understand it, but there is one thing about it. Those kids are concerned. There's another type of young rebel in America, the ones who have opted out altogether, the hippies and their successors, like this girl, whom we will call Ruth, from Texas.
I've been to college 2 years and, you know, I just got up and split one weekend at school. I came from a very middle class, straight family, you know, all my three sisters have graduated from college, you know, and my little brother's on the football team and we go to Sunday school and church, you know, every week. And just very the typical middle class family. My mother knows and she knows more or less. Of course, she'd like for me to come home and talk to me a while. And like I told her, I'm coming home. But like, she'll have to let me come home on my own, you know. She's can't, like, I call her and she gets all upset and asks me to come home and everything, which is groovy. And she knows I love her, you know, and I really do. But I just have to come home on my own time.
The kids like this are rebels, but most of them don't know why or what against or what to do about it. They just cop out. A noted clinical psychologist in New York, Dr. Sabert Basescu, puts it this way.
I'm very sympathetic to the adolescents who object to the value structure in our society, but I'm not at all sympathetic to those who, in the face of what they find to be an objectionable way of life, choose no way of life. And whether they drop out through drugs or through sexuality or through gluing themselves to the television set. In my mind, the tragic era has been made at the point where they commit themselves, in a sense, to dropping out. And however they then go ahead and do it, they've made the major era.
As we said in the beginning, the rebellion of the young is only the most spectacular and the loudest part of the revolution of 1968. There also have been revolutions in other fields, medicine, religion, police work, even sex. And in just a moment, we'll examine those and other aspects of 1968, Year of Revolution.
The battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls, for the times they are a-changing.
Second Sunday, 1968, Year of Revolution. Here again is Lou Wood.
It used to be that a diseased heart meant sure death, either sooner or later. Patients lived without hope, gradually finding less energy and gradually shrinking their circle of interest and finally dying. But suddenly, dramatically, that changed. The news flash came from South Africa. Dr. Christian Bernard had surgically removed a diseased heart and put another healthy one in its place. Suddenly there was hope for those formerly condemned. Heart transplants were tried in many hospitals in many lands, and to date about 100 have been performed. Surely there is no more revolutionary step in medicine than that. It must also be said that there are few procedures so heavy with danger. The mortality rate for heart transplants is almost 50%. That rate becomes almost unimportant, though, when it is pointed out that before transplants, the mortality rate for those with diseased hearts was 100%. It is hardly surprising, therefore, that there are many more persons who want heart transplants than can be accommodated. Dr. Barnard commented on this in an interview with NBC News correspondent Robert Lazich in San Francisco.
In the beginning, we will be unable to cope with the demand for such an operation. But as we go along, we will develop means and develop new techniques, and eventually we will be able to cope.
Do you think that the supply of human hearts will be enough?
No, the supply of human hearts, I don't think, will ever be enough unless we are able to develop some technique by which we can store human hearts for long periods. I would mean weeks or months. But I feel that we will move on to the use of animal hearts eventually and develop techniques and methods by which we can use animal hearts with the same safety as we use human hearts.
Would you suggest what some of those animals might be?
Well, the obvious animal would be, of course, a member of the primate family. This will create some difficulties in that these animals are not easy to come by. The animal that's been studied very widely and has been used, for example, in transplantation of valves has been the pig. And in many ways, the pig's very suitable for transplantation of organs from the pig to the human.
Another killer disease, and one which still maintains its secrets, is cancer. Hundreds of specialists are working on cures. One is F. Kingsley Sanders at Sloan Kettering Cancer Institute in New York. He describes the revolutionary direction his research is taking.
Now, this is an approach which has been spectacularly successful with diseases caused by bacteria. This is mainly because bacterial cells differ in their chemical machinery from human cells, and so one can make a chemical, and Ehrlich many years ago called this his magic bullet, which will seek out the bacterium and destroy it by reason of this difference and leave the human being unaffected. The trouble about doing this with cancer, of course, is that a cancer is you. So that anything which is poisoned the cancer cell will poison you as well. So what one has to do is to devise a chemical which will seek out and exploit differences. The fact that cancer cells divide faster, so you use something which poisons the machinery for making DNA. Now, the cancer cells are making more of them are making DNA than your normal cells, so the normal cells largely escape, although there are certain situations, like in the bone marrow, for example, and also in the intestine, where there are rapidly dividing cells, and in a cancer patient who is being treated chemically, these areas, of course, will suffer. But, I mean, it's a price one is prepared to pay because they will recover.
Vatican II, that historic conclave of Roman Catholic leaders, took place 6 years ago, but its reverberations refuse to die and, in fact, are growing stronger. To the dismay of many, the winds of change have rocked the Vatican itself to the point where the doctrine of papal infallibility is under fire. Pope Paul VI issued an encyclical which said, in effect, that all artificial means of birth control must be avoided by Catholic couples, and suddenly found a revolution within the Church. Uncounted millions of Roman Catholics, in direct defiance of the Pope, continue to use the pill and other means of birth control, and the controversy has grown so strong that recently there were demands that the Pope resign. In another area of controversy, priests in one diocese in the United States have petitioned the Pope to force their bishop to retire. And Protestant faiths, too, have felt the tide of change. Their music has been experimented with, the language of some litanies modernized, one Episcopal bishop has challenged the doctrine of the virgin birth of Christ, and the Methodists have so relaxed the strictures on their behavior that dancing, formerly banned altogether, now is sometimes sponsored within church buildings themselves.
You have the right to remain silent and refuse to answer questions. Do you understand that?
Yeah.
Anything you do, say, may be used against you in a court of law. Do you understand?
Yeah.
You have the right to consult an attorney before speaking to the police and to have an attorney present during any questions now or in the future. Do you understand?
Yeah.
If you cannot afford an attorney, one will be provided for you without cost. Do you understand? Do you understand? If you can't afford an attorney, one will be provided. Yeah. We'll provide one for you.
Okay.
If you do not have an attorney available, you have the right to remain silent until you have an opportunity to consult with one. Do you understand? Do you understand that?
What do you mean? I don't have to talk if I don't
know? Well, let me just say, if you do not have an attorney available, do you have an attorney available now?
I have a lawyer, yeah.
Well, he's not here right now, is he? No. If you do not have an attorney available right now, you have the right to remain silent. You don't have to answer any questions until you've had an opportunity to talk to your lawyer. Do you understand that?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah.
Now that I have advised you of your rights, are you willing to answer questions without an attorney present?
Yeah.
You've just heard a recreation of a prisoner being informed of his rights by an arresting police officer, a procedure that has been common in England for many years, but is revolutionary for local forces in the United States. It's the result of a Supreme Court decision, the Miranda decision, and it has raised up storms of protest within police departments and in courthouses and even in Congress. But the court has stood firm. Justice William O. Douglas, in this lecture to a university class, perhaps gives us some hints of why.
About 100 years ago, well, about 90 years ago, Macaulay came out of England to India to head of a law reform commission. And he looked at police practices in India. Now, policemen, pretty much the same the world around. And in India, what they were doing then, that's hot country. And to run around in the sun is exhausting. Sitting in the shade is easier. So they tie these poor devils under a tree and rub pepper in their eyes until they talked, you see. Well, that was an effective way of getting confession. As a result of Macaulay's findings, they put into the Indian Criminal Code of 1882 a provision that no statement of anybody to a policeman is admissible in evidence in any trial. And that's still in the Indian Criminal Code. If a man wants to talk, he goes to the judge. Now, that doesn't mean in India what it means here. Here it would mean sometimes going to the municipal judge, who in many of our cities need not be a lawyer. He can be a grocery clerk or a cowboy. And they're as ignorant as the police. They what I'm talking about is the Indian system is reference to a judicial officer, a man, and that judicial officer, if he thinks that this man has been held in India too long, recent case he'd been in jail 10 days, and they said we won't take his confession because we feel there is an element of coercion in it. So that's the only country that I know in the world that has followed that path. At the other extreme is the Soviet Union, where everybody can be held 72 hours incommunicado, and where you can get extensions running up to 6 months incommunicado. That's what our policemen really would like. That's a policeman's heaven. And our Constitution, however, was designed to take police, take prosecutors, take judges, take lawmakers off the backs of people.
Others disagree bitterly. For instance, Senator John McClellan of Arkansas.
This Miranda decision has dealt a serious blow to law enforcement. All you have to do is to look at the headlines in the papers. People turn loose who commit violent crime, murder, rape, robbery, simply because of the Miranda case and also the Mallory rule. The court overruled decisions of the court and precedents and procedures that had been established and accepted under the Constitution since the beginning of this republic. Now, when did this court develop the superintelligence that bring it to the conclusion that all of the precedents of the court have been wrong all these years? And I cannot understand what could have possibly motivated the court to overrule those precedents and those decisions and give to the criminal another loophole, a large gap from which to escape the penalties of the law, while at the same time imposing on law enforcement officers a burden and obstruction and shackles that make it very, very difficult for them to apprehend criminals and bring them to justice in our courts.
What about the police themselves? One prominent chief who spoke to this point was Herbert Jenkins, chief of police in Atlanta, who was interviewed by NBC News reporter Carl Stern.
The ultimate goal and the objectives of the police and the courts are identical. Then the only disagreement that can develop is to how you achieve these goals. You must go and develop all of your facts and have your facts supported with physical evidence and testimony, so when you take the suspect into custody, you have the right man and you don't have to ask him a lot of questions. It requires more work. It makes police work more expensive. Where one detective could have worked up a case, it'll now take three or four over a long period of time. Certainly we have criminals and we're taking lots of them in custody and we're getting a lot of convictions. But offhand, I don't know of any single one that could be identified as being free because of this decision.
Is your conviction rate lower today because of these court decisions?
I don't think it's any lower. I think it's as good or perhaps a little better because we have better prepared cases when we go to court under the Miranda decision than we had beforehand.
Another revolution in police work has been wrought not by court decisions, but by the very conditions of society itself, of our times, and the pressures created by our swiftly moving, almost overwhelming civilization. This is the realization by most police forces, at least in the cities, that the cop is not just an enforcer of the law, that he must become something additional, that he must have a sense of social justice as well. Again, Atlanta Chief Jenkins.
We've got these 40 or 50 people in Crime Prevention Bureau. We've got a task force of 40 Negro officers that's under the command of a Negro captain. Now, the Crime Prevention Bureau officers are working in the poor neighborhoods every day, getting acquainted, giving assistance, providing a social service as well as a police service. And then from 4:30 p.m. till 12:30 midnight, the task force, which is 40 Negro officers with a commanding Negro captain, they're assigned right into the same neighborhood. And they are providing a good, tough police service for the law-abiding citizens of these neighborhoods. And that was one of the major complaints of the Negro, and I think a legitimate complaint. The law-abiding citizens there were not getting the police service and protection that they were entitled to. So again, we're providing that. It's a two-prong operation.
Everyone must be aware that a sexual revolution is going on in this country. Evidence is everywhere, in the movies, in the magazines, in books, in the paperbacks that are openly displayed, and in human behavior. Dr. Albert Ellis is a student of that behavior. He's well known through his books and lectures, particularly a volume entitled Sex Without Guilt. Dr. Ellis was interviewed by NBC News correspondent Jeffrey Pond.
To what extent is guilt a factor in sex relations in America today?
Well, fortunately, to a much less extent. I've been in the practice of psychotherapy and sex and marriage and family counseling for 25 years now, and it used to be a big factor in the disturbances of my patients and in the people I speak to as I go on lecture tours throughout the country. But now, fortunately, as I said, it's a much less factor.
What are the young people doing in sex today in relation to guilt compared to their elders?
Young people today are not only having certain sex practices which they didn't have, and this especially goes for the females who are much less virginal than they used to be, but they're thinking about sex for one of the first times in our history. They're really asking, is this wrong just because the Bible or my parents said it is wrong? And if it is wrong, how will I calmly correct it instead of putting myself down for doing it?
Is petting coming along at a time in their lives when the first kiss was in the older generation's life?
Yes, very definitely. They're not only petting, but they're going way beyond the smooching and the hugging of 30 and 40 years ago, in that they're very frequently petting to orgasm. Females sometimes deliberately do this with the male in order not to have intercourse with him.
Many parents now seem to be in a quandary as to how to handle this. What would you advise, and what should the parent expect will happen regardless of his advice?
Well, for youngsters, the children from puberty, 12 or 13, on to 16 or 17, I advise the parent very strongly, but with condemnation, to tell the child that, look, dear, there are a few real dangers of intercourse, such as pregnancy, and consequently it would be wise if you only petted and did not literally have intercourse. Now, in the older age brackets of the 18s and the 19 teenagers, I think, especially on the college level, that they can be fairly well left to decide for themselves whether they're going to have intercourse and what they're going to do about it, but they'd better be trained in school and at home to take wise precautions.
How do young people respond? Second Sunday visited a class in humanities in a Westchester County high school and taped a discussion of 10th graders considering changing values of sex in a changing world.
I think sex is just as well known now as it was then, except I think it's more brought out in the open at this point. I think it was more like a sin to talk about it. It was something you didn't talk about. But now it's brought out. I mean, like, we can have these kind of discussions and everything.
I think there's maybe more of an open awareness day because books and movies and stuff are, like, a lot different from what they were, like, when our parents were young. Like, when my mother said she saw a girl in the wind, they thought one said, when he said, I don't give a damn, they thought it was the worst thing anyone could ever say.
The thing is that people that are younger, different than their parents, they're beginning to realize that sex isn't just some evil pleasure that you go after. It has beauty to it.
Maybe parents are pushing their kids out sooner, but they don't want their kids to have to do with this big thing about sex. They don't want them getting in trouble with it.
I think that the family is coming apart, but in a way it's becoming closer, and that we can talk to our family about some things. And we're more open to say things that we wouldn't have been 5 years ago. I think that's completely wrong. There are basically two topics you can't talk to parents about, and that's drugs and sex.
I think today your parents can tell you what's right and what's wrong, but really, your parents don't want to believe that you would do anything wrong. Like, they can say, oh, someone else's child might be indulging in sex, but they wouldn't want to believe that about their own child. Like, parents are strange people because they...
One observer of life and events, one concerned observer, is NBC newsman Chet Huntley. We asked him for his conclusions.
1968 has been, by any standard, a difficult and sometimes unmanageable year. But it cannot be isolated and evaluated by itself, out of the context of its era. 1968 was really only more of this half century. Measured in its age, it is more of the same. Never has the human race experienced anything comparable to these last 50 years. Two world wars and a number of smaller ones. An incredible multiplication of population. An explosion of information bombarding us with all the impact of split-second immediacy. In much of the world, a mass migration from rural to urban environment. A sudden end of colonialism and empires. The advent of scores of new nations, each one jealous of its sovereignty and pursuing its self-interest in a shrunken international jungle. We Americans have tried to adjust to yet another impact of change, the sudden loss of isolated national security in which we could pursue the even tenor of our ways. Change, sudden, cruel, abrupt change. These have been the characteristics of our recent years, including 1968. We're not yet sure what all these changes of environment and thought have done to us. They have done something. Perhaps they have not changed us for the better. Or, more hopefully, they have only made it somewhat more difficult to be better. To build thee more stately mansions, O my soul.
As we said at the beginning, many of us who are older want to tell the whirling world, slow down. But it won't. And so, Second Sunday has tried to gain some insights into the tornado of our times. And tonight we have reviewed the year in an effort to summarize and perhaps to understand a little better the year 1968, a year of revolution. I hope we have succeeded. This is Lou Wood, NBC News.
You've been listening to Second Sunday, 1968, Year of Revolution, a production of NBC News, written and produced by Albert Burchard, directed by Don Washington, tape editing by Warren Hogan. The narrator was Lou Wood. This is Arthur Gary.